Tonight we're going to look at just a few verses in the third chapter of Ecclesiastes. As a matter of fact, we're going to finish this chapter. If you recall, last Sunday night we looked at the first 15 verses. So tonight we'll start in verse 16 and go through verse 22. I call this section Life and Justice. Life and Justice. I want to start actually with the last two verses of the former paragraph. Look at verses 14 and 15. And then we'll move straight in to the next paragraph. Because the first word in verse 16 is and the next word is moreover. Which means he is adding from the last thought of that paragraph into the first thought of this last section. And he's talking about something that has to do with judgment, particularly the judgment of God upon man. Note verse 14. I know that whatsoever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor can anything be taken from it. In other words, you can't take away from God's will. You cannot add to God's will. God's will be done as it is. God doeth it that man should fear before him. In other words, whatever God does, and particularly you and I know from the revealed will of God in the Bible, how God operates, and that's the only way we'd really know how God operates. We could see things going on in life, but we wouldn't know why, for the Bible reveals why. Questions, answers. So the point is, in order that man might fear God or respect God. Now look at the next verse. That which has been is now. In other words, if you look back in the past, you say, well, a lot of what happened in the past is even present now, is even true now. And God allows things that have happened in the past to even happen now. How many of you have ever heard the expression, they who do not learn from history are destined to repeat it. Repeat it when? Now, tomorrow, if there's a tomorrow, and so forth. Then the rest of the verse says, and that which is to be, in other words, that which would be in the future, has already been. In other words, nothing really is going to be new in general principles in the future that's not even true right now. And he's going to talk about some of that when we get to our study tonight. So then it says, and God requireth that which is past. In other words, I'm going to be judged based upon, you're going to be judged based upon what my life has been. Okay? Have you ever thought about the fact, and I guess we don't want to dwell on this thought of our mortality, that when our time is over, when we die, we are judged on our past. Okay, it's appointed unto man once to die, after this the judgment. So I'm judged at death, not of what I will do in the future. I am judged on my past. Because by the way, 1 second after death, if the Lord doesn't come back in our lifetime, we know what the judgment day is going to be for us. The rich man in Luke 16, he knows what the day of judgment is going to be for him. Lazarus, Abraham, in Luke 16. They know what the judgment day is going to be for them. The gulf is fixed. One cannot pass from one to the other. So the point is, every man shall give account of his own works. Romans 14 and verse 12. Now then, he starts in verse 16 and says, and moreover, in other words, knowing that God is going to require, he's going to judge us according to our lives, moreover, I saw under the sun, meaning as I observe life, I saw under the sun the place of judgment. Now, you and I would use a different phrase there. We would call it, I went to the courthouse and I looked. Several years ago, when I was a student at Fried Hardeman, I was in an automobile accident. I wasn't driving. My cousin was. I was in the back seat. And the person who rear-ended him and didn't have any insurance. So we had to go through a court system in order for the insurance company that he had basically to recoup anything that was done with reference to his automobile. And he had to go through an attorney. I had never been in a courtroom really, in a real sense, other than maybe visit as a kid and didn't have a big impression on it, until right then. College student, Henderson, Tennessee, in the Chester County Courthouse. Well, before our case actually came up at the Chester County Courthouse, because they called your case from You know, we're going to see this one, and then when that rules on that one, then with next case, when they call your case, that's when you went up before the bench or before the judge. So we're sitting out where you call the gallery would sit, where anybody that would be visiting in the courtroom would sit. And our case wasn't the first case. Ours was, I don't know, two or three in line. And I remember sitting there and watching the case before our case. And I thought, this is pretty interesting. As a matter of fact, I told my cousin, this is really entertaining. Like the People's Court. You remember that's on television? People would watch that. Okay? And anything that had to do with courtroom scenes or CSI, I was watching that in real life. And it wasn't crime scenes. It was more civil matters than it was anything else. But when you get a person who's got money involved and a person over here who wants to take it away from them by means of court, and you're sitting there and say, well, okay, if I were a juror in this particular case, which they didn't have a jury, the judge is the one that decided thumbs up or thumbs down on the case. Here's a person screaming their lungs out trying to get the judge to rule in their favor, and here's a person screaming louder than that person trying to get the judge to rule in their favor. And I looked at my cousin, I said, and this is real life. This isn't television. And it was really funny to watch these two West Tennessee people just have at it one another in a courtroom. And I said, well, how's this judge going to rule in this? And finally, the judge gave a ruling. By the way, the one that was, you know, the victor in that ruling, they were all smiles. Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. By the way, what do you think the other person's response was to the ruling that went against them? Okay? And I thought, well, I know God knows what the truth is, and hopefully the judge ruled in the right way. But do you honestly believe in every courtroom from the smallest court all the way to the Supreme Court in our country, it always rules correctly? What's the only courtroom that is always 100% going to rule correctly? Heaven. God, because not only does He know the case, He even knows the hearts of all of us by which to make a ruling there in that case. Okay? So I'm looking at the place of judgment. It's like I'm going to the courthouse. By the way, that would probably be the gates of the city. That's where the elders of the city would sit and cases would be tried. Each city sometimes would have its own judge, and he would be the arbitrator between controversies in situation. So I go to the place of judgment. Here's what I saw, he said, that wickedness was there. You mean you go to the courthouse and what you find out, instead of it being a total place of righteousness, you found wickedness there. I saw wickedness going on. Then he says, and the place of righteousness, that iniquity was there. He says, even judges that were highly respected and even times when a person would generally rule in the favor of the rule of law, not the rule of man. By the way, you know the difference between the rule of law and the rule of man. The rule of law is, as the principle of law is to be upheld, so it's upheld. Rule of man is the golden rule. He that has the gold makes the rules. Okay. By the way, I get a paper called Imprimis. It's from a college called Hilldale College up in North, and there's a man by the name of Ron Paul. Have you ever heard of Ron Paul? Politician. And sometimes he'll speak up there, and Mr. Ryan, who actually was vice presidential candidate of the last presidential election, by the way, that did not win, there's a Republican vice presidential candidate, he gave a speech 4th of July and was talking about the rule of law. And when I was reading this, I thought, well, this is Ecclesiastes 3. This is my sermon Sunday night. He was talking about how that we have right now in the United States of America a political party with its power structure right now in the White House and in certain sections of Congress and the Senate and so forth, and even in lower cases in the states, a push for progressivism. And the idea is that they don't want to abide by the rule of law or the Constitution as it is given. They want it that to be out of date, and they want to push now what's called a new agenda. And what's happened is they want us to give them the power to tell us how to live our lives. That's basically a speech he gave around the 4th of July this year up at Hilldale College. And he basically came down and said, the founding fathers of this country knew oppression by the rule of man. When King George in England and Parliament and so forth in England was basically telling the colonies in this country, this is what you're going to do or else. And it wasn't fair. It wasn't based on the goodness of the people of this country. Basically, what did this country do? Well, if you're going to starve us out, if you're going to tax us to our death, we might as well fight to the death. Like, go out in the blaze of glory if you're going to go out. And the Revolutionary War happened. And here we are with our independence from Great Britain. And the Constitution is written. By the way, Bill of Rights ultimately came in. Why? Because the Constitution was not a panacea. In other words, it didn't solve all the problems. So the Bill of Rights, okay, and amendments to the Constitution began to be added. Why? Because the Founding Fathers did not foresee certain things. So the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and the amendments kept on going. Why? To hold on to the fact that the foundation of this country is in that Constitution. When the President of the United States takes the oath of office in this country, every president, by the way, he is making an oath to do what? To defend and protect the Constitution of the United States of America, is he not? Go back and listen to when they give their, oath of office and listen to the words. Go back and read that. That's what I am here to protect and to defend the Constitution of the United States. And then the addition, so help me God. You remember that phrase? So help me God. What does that mean? That means the Constitution of the United States of America is the rule of law by which the President of the United States is to operate. All right? What is the Constitution? Okay? What are the rights of Christians before the courtroom of heaven? It's called the Bible. This right here is what we're going to be judged by. I don't have any doubt about it. John 12:48 says that. He that rejecteth me receiveth not my words as one that judges him. The word I have spoken, same will judge him in the last day. And that verse is talking to me. It's talking to you. So, the rule of law is God made the law and that's how I will be ruled. All right? Solomon says, I went out into the courthouses and watched these judges operate among people. And here's what I found. What I found was, in an ideal world, wickedness is put down and righteousness is always exalted. In an ideal world. But folks, we don't live in an ideal world, do we? We live in the real world. And the real world says that one day all wrongs will be put down and all rights will be vindicated. But right now, we don't live in the ideal world. We live in the real world. And the real world is disappointing, isn't it? How many of you have ever heard the expression, life's not fair? Life's just not fair. How many of you have ever known anybody to get so discouraged they just want to give up life altogether, actually commit suicide because things are just not going in their favor? This is bad, and this is bad, and this is bad, and nothing's going right for me, so hey, I might as well check out. And who am I going to get to help me check out? I'll just take it in my own power. And people do that. Why? Because in their mind, things ought to operate. In other words, my ship ought to come in at least one time in life. And they get so discouraged. Really, so discouraged. Just give up altogether. Solomon says, I was looking for God's will to be done by the judges, these high-ranking officials in the place of judgment and justice. And what I found was there's wickedness in there. And even among those that were righteous, I found sometimes iniquity crept in. By the way, would you say that's even true tonight among human beings? Is anybody sinless in the world today? No. So, let's now look at the situation here. Look at this earthly perspective. Verse 16, here's his investigation. I started looking, and here's what I found. So now verses 17 to 21. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked. What does he mean by that? Well, he says, well, man's not doing a good job of this thing called justice. God will have to take care of it. By the way, will God take care of it? No question. No doubt he will. Okay? The rest of the verse says, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. By the way, if you go back to the first part of Ecclesiastes 3, to everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven. When it comes to God putting down wrongs and vindicating rights, that time's coming. But right now, it's not really being done. So, we understand that and we live in the real reality of that. Look at verse 18. I said in my heart, by the way, this is his interpretation of as he looks at it. I said in my heart concerning the estate of the sons of men. The word estate there means the affairs, the activities of man. That God might manifest them and that they might see that they themselves are beasts. Now, I don't know if you've ever dealt with a religious persuasion called the Jehovah's Witnesses. But if you ever sit down to talk with a person of that particular religious group, these are the sugar stick verses they'll use to teach their doctrine. That you and I don't have a soul that is eternal, that when the body dies, the soul goes to God, like Jesus said on the cross, Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit. They don't believe that doctrine. They don't teach that doctrine. They teach that when you die, you're just like an animal that dies. An animal doesn't have a soul, and you don't have a soul. You have a life, a physical life, and to a degree you have a higher life, a physicality, than an animal does. But an animal has a life, you have a life, animal dies, you die. Get used to it. Listen, if I didn't believe in the resurrection, if I didn't believe in eternal life, I would eat, drink, and be merry. And I would quit preaching altogether. Matter of fact, I'd never read my Bible again. Do you think I'd ever pay a price for trying to do what's right? Notice, I'm wanting, Solomon says, to God to show everybody that they are beasts. They there, I believe, has reference to these people that are perverting justice, because those that are maintaining the righteousness of God, doing the right thing as best as they can, they understand they're accountable to God. But these people who are wicked and they want to use wickedness to get their own achievements, to receive their own ends, and even those that are righteous that may want to twist something so that they can think they can get something out of sin, Solomon's basically saying, I want in this life for them to realize that that's no better than living like an animal. By the way, how do animals live? What is the basic instinct God puts in animals to live, to survive? What does an atheist and an agnostic say is the life of animals? Well, I know what Darwin said, survival of the fittest. You know what Darwin said? The strongest survive. The weak, basically, are culled out. The strong take care of the weak. And therefore, evolution basically argues that the weak are ultimately discarded as the strong keep on rising. And so they keep on evolving, keep on developing. Okay? Well, is that the way God operates? Listen, when God sent His Son into the world, look at the conditions. The very Son of God, God in the flesh, came into the world. Born into a poor family, in the smallest of towns of Judea, Bethlehem, and was born technically in a barn. Okay? And His cradle was a feeding trough for animals. Now, if you were going to do it, and you were going to take the very Son of God, the one who, by the way, is a creator of all physical things, according to Colossians chapter 1, how would you do it? Would you put him in Buckingham Palace, like over in England, like the pomp and the ceremony and the circumstance and so forth they give over there? Put a silver spoon in his mouth? See, God doesn't do things like man thinks they ought to be done, that God be glorified and not man. And really, the entire Bible is that way. God's plan for the salvation of man would have never come up with it the way God did. By the way, man cannot tell God, well, I had it all figured out. No, man didn't have that figured out. God reveals to us what His will is, what His plan is, and because it is so contrary to the way man thinks, God will be glorified. Notice the next verse. He says, for they which befall the sons of men befalls beasts, or that which befalls mankind also falls beasts. Even one being falleth them, as one dies, so the other dies. Yea, they've all one breath, so that a man has no more preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity. Now, can you see how a Jehovah's Witness would use this verse to say you're nothing more than an animal? As though it's point blank saying there's no difference between you and an animal. Animal dies, you die, therefore you're an animal. That's all you are. But let me ask you this question. How do you know, K-N-O-W, how do you know you got a soul? How do you know you got a soul? Okay. Put the Bible aside. How do you know you got a soul? You ever seen one? You ever seen a soul? You ever seen a soul separated from a body? Folks, I've seen people die. I've been in the rooms when they took their last breath. When the head nurse comes in and puts the stethoscope on the chest, listening for the last beat of the heart. I've seen that. I'm going to tell you something. I didn't see anything leaving the body. I didn't see anything crawl out of the body like Hollywood movies do. All I saw was a body that was dying is now dead. That's what I saw. And if I didn't have this right here, I wouldn't know a soul even existed. Would I know a body exists? Well, I'm looking at you. You're looking at me. I would know a body exists. Do animals have bodies? Animals have bodies, right? Animals have life in them. They're breathing, right? When an animal quits breathing, does the body die? When a human being's body quits breathing, does the body die? Sure it does. Then what's the difference between you and me and a dog out here that get killed in the road? What's the difference? If you and I didn't have this, we wouldn't know the difference. But thank God we got one of these. Because this right here tells you something that you won't learn by observation. What this right here says is, let us make man in our own image, after our own likeness. And God made man in His own image. In the image of God created He him. Male and female created He them. Genesis 1, verses 26 and 27. By the way, to be fair with the book of Ecclesiastes, the book of Ecclesiastes itself teaches you're more than flesh and blood like an animal. Look at chapter 12. Go all the way to the end of the book, chapter 12, when he's talking about the process of dying in figurative language. And look at what he says in verse 7. Then shall the dust return to the earth as it was. Well, what is the dust that returns to the earth as it was? That's the physical body. That's what God made man of the earth and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being or a living soul. He became alive. Life. That which was not animated now becomes animated or alive. Well, what happens when death occurs? The soul doesn't die. The body dies. For as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also. James 2, verse 26. By the way, I use that verse to two Jehovah's Witnesses that came to the door of the house one day. The Jehovah's Witness doctrine about the soul is, every time you find the word soul or spirit in your Bible, what they mean by that is the air coming in and out of your lungs. That's what they mean by that. And I know that because I've studied their doctrine. What you are is, you're a physical body that is now alive as long as you've got brain waves and breath. And basically, when you stop breathing, you die. So here's what I asked them one day. I said, Have you ever had the wind knocked out of you? You ever had the breath knocked out of you? By the way, have you? I have. I said, were you dead? I said, I didn't say, well, did you think you was dead? I said, by the way, if you've ever really had the wind knocked out of you, you think you're dying, right? Because the muscles in your diaphragm go into spasms. And until it actually relaxes, you won't start back to breathing. But ultimately, it'll settle down and all of a sudden the diaphragm will start working and you'll start breathing. The woman said, no, I wasn't dead. I said, but you said and you believe that the spirit of man, as the Bible teaches it, is nothing but the air in and out of your lungs. And you just admitted that you'd had the wind knocked out of you, but then you tell me your body wasn't dead. In other words, you can't have it both ways, ma'am. When the soul leaves the body dies. And the rest of Ecclesiastes 12:7 says, and the spirit returns unto God who gave it. By the way, where is God? He's in the third heaven. The air in your lungs is not going to the third heaven. But you are. And that's in the book of Ecclesiastes. So if Ecclesiastes 12:7 says there's two parts to us, there's a physical side, and then there's an eternal side that lives forever, then what on earth does Ecclesiastes 3 mean? That I'm nothing more than like a beast. The beast dies, and I die. What it means is, if I just looked with my eyes at life, that's exactly the way it would look. By the way, how do animals treat one another? In a court of law. If, let's say animals had a court of law, and this animal mistreated this animal. By the way, do animals mistreat one another? Do some animals do some things to an animal over here that's done absolutely nothing to this animal? Okay? Just because I want to do this to you, run you off, I feel threatened by you. And then, okay, let's take those animals to court, to animal court, and let's let that be settled out. That's ridiculous, isn't it? Just the thought of that's ridiculous. But the idea is, does the animal that needs punishing, does it always be punished? Is it always punished? No. By the way, survival of the fittest, right? We call it the pecking order in the animal kingdom. Well, folks, that can happen in the world among human beings. You ever heard the expression, might makes right? Might makes right. In other words, I got the strength, I can overpower you, I'll overpower you, I'm the king of the mountain. By the way, y'all ever played that game? King of the mountain. Don't necessarily recommend that game, by the way, but it's quite interesting to watch. Phyllis and I have quite a few cousins on our mother's side, and that's what we used to play in the back bedroom of our grandparents' house, King of the Mountain. We used the bed of our grandparents' house back there in that bedroom, and we cut the lights out on the house in that room. And then all of a sudden, you've never heard as much slapping and screaming and slinging against the walls and hair snatching and whatever. And all of a sudden, after everybody's had about all they want, whoever's standing in the middle of the bed when the lights cut on is king of the mountain. By the way, that's how you play that game. By the way, it can get quite rough with like 15 cousins going at each other. Animals do that, right? Oh, y'all quit. That's not right. You're hurting somebody. Animals don't care, right? Might makes right. Then you look at the world and people treat one another that way. Man's inhumanity to man. For example, after World War II was over, there was what was called the Nuremberg Trials. You remember that? The Nuremberg Trials. What was that all about? War crimes, wasn't it? Well, what's war about? You know what the object of war is not to play fair. You know what the object of war is? The object of war is to win. That is the philosophy of war. And in many ways, the tactics of war is it really don't matter how you win as long as you win. That's war. Let me ask you a question. Is that little by little becoming the philosophy of sports in this country? It really doesn't matter how you get the W as long as you get the W. What is that? Philosophy of the world. If a person loses and he becomes persecuted and he suffers and loses his life, has he lost? Not if he suffered for righteousness' sake. For theirs is the kingdom of heaven, Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 and verse 10. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Rejoice, be exceeding glad. Great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets that are before you. Matthew 5, verse 12. All right, it may not be fair down here. You'll get your reward. Everything will be made right in heaven. Let's move on just to finish. Notice this. As now we get on down to the chapter. He says, all go into one place. Verse 20, all are of the dust. All return to the dust again. By the way, if you read Proverbs 12 and verse 7, you find out you're not just dust. The dust goes back to the earth, but the spirit goes to God that gave it. So he's only looking at your physical body here, not the spiritual side. So verse 21, who knows the spirit of man that goes upward? That would be Ecclesiastes 12 and 7, goes back to God that gave it. And the spirit of the beast, or the wind that comes out of the beast, goes down to the earth. In other words, it just quits breathing. So even that concept right there shows that man's more than an animal. But does man die like animals die? Yes. Okay. So in a court of justice, if a person is being tried for a capital offense, to be publicly executed for a capital offense, like premeditated murder or something along that line, does the murderer always end up dying in this country, in this world? No. Does the person who is the victim of a murder, are they always honored? No. Then what do? We just throw up our hands and say, it's not fair. Now, how am I going to live my life? Well, how you're going to live your life is, God, in the day of judgment, will correct all wrongs. That's how you live your life. So now we come to the implication, verse 22. Solomon, when he's observing this and he sees this unfairness, this not less than ideal, as we'd say, he says, wherefore, drawing a conclusion, I perceive there is nothing better. By the way, this is perception under the sun. Not inspired perception in the sense that God told him to draw this conclusion. This is perception under the sun. Because the real conclusion of the whole matter is what? Fear God, keep His commandments. Ecclesiastes 12, 13. So here's his perception of this situation. That man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion. In other words, just keep your nose clean, work hard, enjoy the fruits of your labor, and understand life's not fair. God will take care of things in the judgment, but right now, just do your best to live your life. That's pretty tough to say and live, isn't it? But in a real sense, that's what you got to fall back on. And then, of course, the last. For who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? The answer to that question is God Almighty will. God will. You ever been done dirty by some human being or group of human beings? How'd you respond to that? I guess I'd say, how do you react to that? Whenever wrongs come our way that we don't deserve, by the way, sometimes wrongs come when we do deserve them, right? But when wrongs come our way and we don't deserve it, how we choose to respond has everything to do with life. How we choose to respond. Come to the New Testament, we find that life is more than meets the eye. Luke 12. You remember there was a brother who came to Jesus and said, Lord, divide the inheritance between me and my brother. He didn't think his brother was treating him fairly. Jesus said, who made me a judge or an arbitrator between you? Basically saying, I'm not going to do what you're asking me to do. Then he says, beware and take heed of covetousness, for man's life consists not in the abundance of the things which he possesses. In other words, you may have been treated unfairly, and you think this is my due that I ought to get, and you may not get that. But let me explain to you something. Life is not about getting what you think you deserve. Life is something else. In Ephesians chapter 4, verse 17 beginning, Paul's writing to these brethren. He says, I exhort therefore and testify that you henceforth walk not as other Gentiles walk, in the vanity of their mind, the way they think and the way they live. Having their understanding darkened, being alienated, watch this, from the life of God through the ignorance that is in them because of the blindness of their heart. Verse 19, I didn't put on the screen. Verse 19 says, who being past feeling have given themselves over to lasciviousness to work all uncleanness, watch this phrase, with greediness. What's the bottom line of the world's philosophy of life? Greed, isn't it? More, more. I want this. I want my way. I want my prestige. I want this. I want this. I want that. And until I get it, I'm going to keep on pursuing it. What is the pursuit of the Christian? Verse 20, you have not so learned Christ. In other words, you're living here to go to heaven. So we come then to John chapter 10, verse 10. I am come that you might have life and have it more abundantly. John 14, 6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And no man comes unto the Father but by me. What do I want more in life? What do I see with my eyes? No, this is not what I want to see. This is not what I want in life. What I want in life is what I can't see. Right? My clothes, my body, this building, my car, my home, real estate, whatever. What's the Lord going to do with all that in the day of judgment? What does 2 Peter chapter 3, 10 and 11 say God's going to do to every physical thing you and I see? By the way, can he do whatever he wants to with it? Does it belong to him anyway? He's going to burn it all up, isn't he? Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought we to be in all holy conversation and godliness? Looking for and hastening unto the coming of the day of the Lord, in which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for a new heaven and a new earth wherein dwells righteousness. Where are you looking? Solomon said, if I was looking for life down here, man, am I disappointed. I look for judges to be fair, to deal with cases that need to be dealt with. And I walked in there and I saw wickedness in the courtroom. It's not just outside out here in the world. It's right there where righteousness ought to be shown. It's just as rotten in the courtroom as it is out here in the world, he said. Then high in the world is right going to be vindicated in the day of judgment. By the way, that's what Genesis to Revelation says. But that's basically what he's driving at here. So, enjoy your life, do right, and wait on your ultimate judge to make it all right. If you're here tonight, you're not a child of God. Obviously, God created you to serve him, brought you into life, by which then to have the greatest life, the Christian life, and ultimately to have eternal life in heaven. If you're subject to heaven's invitation, need to be baptized tonight, we're here to assist you. If you need to come back to your first love, Tim Lair and I will be down front. While together we stand and sing. Would you?